This is Yonder. Hi, everyone. Jeff Robbins here with the Yonder Podcast, where we talk to company leaders and big thinkers about how to make remote work. We're focused on expanding the remote work job market and helping listeners to create happy, productive, distributed teams. This time, we're talking with Jared Bittner, who is the development manager and a developer at Lullabot. Disclaimer, the company I co-founded back in 2006. I've since stepped away from the company, but Jared still works there and does a lot of wears a lot of different hats, but he's also particularly interested in virtual reality, which is what we're talking about on the podcast today. This topic has come up a fair amount in talking with people about sort of the ways that we communicate or the ways that we can communicate and this idea that virtual reality might be sort of a future technology. Maybe we aren't talking in Slack so much. We're putting on headsets and stepping into the Ready Player One movie style immersive world and meeting our virtual teams in virtual space. Or maybe it's just all weird. I don't know. It's up to you. But here's the podcast. We're going to give you a bunch of information. Turns out for basically just $400, you can buy a headset that will do pretty much all of this that you need to do without even needing an external computer with it. So, but I'll leave it to you as to whether this is a direction you want to pursue or not. But it's a really fascinating conversation with Jared and a chance to kind of immerse you in this sort of new potential direction for remote work, virtual communication stuff. If you're not already subscribed to the Yonder newsletter, yonder.io/newsletter, it comes out every other week and we'll let you know about new podcasts when they come out. We also have articles that come out on the Yonder website. And we'll let you know about those. And we'll find little snippets and bits and pieces of information from around the internet that you should know about when you're keeping up with your remote work knowledge. yonder.io/newsletter is where you can subscribe for that. While you're on the website, you can and should subscribe to the Yonder podcast, which you're listening to right now. So if you're not subscribed, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, you can subscribe at all of those places, and you can find links to those on the Yonder website in the upper right-hand corner, I think it is. The link says subscribe or something to that end. And you should do that. I also want to tell you about my business coaching and mentorship practice. This isn't something that I've mentioned too much on this podcast, but for the past 2 or 3 years since exiting Lullabot, the company I started back in 2006, I've been working with owners and leaders of various types of businesses, both remote and co-located, to act as sort of a virtual business partner, someone to check in with weekly and work out the issues that you need to keep your company and yourself happy, sustainable, and help you move towards your goals, whether those are to grow your company or simply to make sure that your company fits into your personal needs. Make sure that you work for your company and your company works for you. There you go. We think a lot about brand and marketing and sales pipelines and also stuff like culture and group dynamics and company growth. I've done a lot of brainstorming with my clients, helping to develop products and new initiatives for their companies. And if you'd like to set up a call and talk about working with me to help make your company better, visit jjeff.com. That's jjeff.com. And that's my business coaching and mentorship site. And you can find out more there and fill out the form and we can set up a call and I can tell you more about what it's like to work with me in that capacity. But if you'd just like to work with me in the capacity of listening to a podcast, Well, let's just do that and get to our interview with Jared Bittner. Hi, Jared. Welcome to the Yonder Podcast.
Hey, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Very, very well. Thank you.
I should mention for everyone listening that Jared and I are old friends and work acquaintances. Jared, how long ago did you start working at Lullabot?
It will be 10 years in March.
Wow.
Yeah.
and we met probably 2 years before that when you came to a workshop that we were teaching that I was part of and
Providence.
Yeah. And now you're a superstar. Well, first of all, the question I ask everyone, where are you talking to us from today?
I am in Gig Harbor, Washington, which is just a little bit north of Tacoma.
Wow. And do you work from home or do you have
Yeah. I've worked from home for a long time now. I had a room upstairs. My daughter got older, wanted her own room. So we built a small room in the garage and have a garage office, or I like to call it a studio, I guess, but
it's all about, you know, how you sell it to yourself.
Yeah,
you know?
It really is.
You could have a basement boutique studio with no windows. Yeah. Well, so why don't you introduce yourself to people?
Sure. My name is Jared Bittner. I am, currently by day, I am a development manager and project manager at Lullabot. Work on large scale websites. Current client is IBM. I've been working for them for actually almost 2 years now. It's been a pretty long gig, but it's really good. And I think by night, I would say I am a creative technologist working mainly in the field of virtual reality.
Yeah. And that's kind of why we got you on the podcast. We've had several guests now that have sort of talked about virtual reality as kind of like a future of remote work. It's certainly a future technology, future communications technology, a new way of kind of interacting. And I thought, oh, I know a VR guy who's really interested in that, and you and I talked a few months ago, and thought it would be a good idea to have you on the podcast, and we could kind of have a conversation about, to some extent, the state of VR, and kind of like, you know, what it is, what works, even potentially, you know, what doesn't work, and what people might kind of look for and think about, you know, are we at that tipping point yet? Are we ready for everyone to start wearing goggles at home, doing all their virtual remote work, or where are we at with that? But let's kind of start with the history of things a little bit. Talk to me about your, when you got into VR and kind of what the state of things were then, and then maybe we can kind of, you know, kind of walk it forward to kind of get closer to now.
Yeah, I started into VR as most things, kind of hobbyist, and it was October of 2014 when I said, I'm buying myself a birthday present, and it's going to be the Oculus DK2. The DK2 was the second development kit that Oculus was coming out with after their acquisition by Facebook for an ungodly amount of money.
So was DK, does it mean like it was sort of pre-consumer release,
yes,
developer stuff, sort of like the Google goggles? Yep. Have not actually technically been released publicly yet, as far as I know, right?
Development kit is more, it's geared towards developers. It's usually somewhat subsidized, so it's a little bit cheaper that developers can get into it. and just start experimenting with the technology to see what they can do with it and to hopefully yeah. learn how to create content with that stuff. Because by the time you get to a consumer release, you want to have a pretty flourishing ecosystem of content sure. to, you know, give yep. to the consumer. So, yeah.
So what could you do with it back then?
Well, back then, basically it was only a headset. You just had a headset that you could put on. It had, you know, stereoscopic view, and you could, there was a couple different demos. One of the famous demos was one called Tuscany, where you basically had this place in Tuscany that you could go to and walk around this house. There wasn't a whole lot of interaction or anything, but it sort of showcased the ability to look around a three-dimensional space while sitting at your desk, using your keyboard and mouse as sort of navigation. And you know, you could look around, and it could track your head, but that was basically it.
Right. So no positional right. stuff. You couldn't, when you say you could walk around in the house, you had to mouse yes. around or arrow right. key around to
yep,
move
like
forward
and back.
Yeah,
like a video game. Okay. You know, you press forward with your arrow key and you go forward, and you're actually just still sitting there, but it feels like you're going forward. And you know, that's when they right. started realizing things like simulation sickness was a thing.
So let's make sure we're explaining this, you know, kind of beginner for everybody who's listening. So simulation sickness is a form of motion sickness. It's kind of the opposite of motion sickness, right? Motion sickness is oftentimes is caused because your eyes are not seeing the motion. You're in a vehicle, but your body's feeling a motion and because of this disconnect, your brain thinks, oh, I must be yeah. sick. Or someone must have drugged me, so I need to get this drug yeah. out of my system.
Exactly.
I should throw up. And this is sort of the opposite, right? In that you're seeing motion, but your body's
right.
not
your
feeling
motion.
Your brain
is perceiving motion, and your body is not. And so there's where the disconnect happens. And it still is like, yeah, I ate some bad berries. I need to throw up.
Right. Right, yeah. It's evolution, folks. It's working for you. Yeah, but...
So
right,
that is
okay.
a thing, yeah.
we're eating fewer bad berries these days than we are using VR. But so how is that... how have things evolved yeah. over time? You know, walk me forward maybe a year or two from there to kind of like, you know, things starting to come out into the consumer world. What problems yeah. have been fixed?
Well, specifically and, with locomotion, know. I think, and trying to make sure that people aren't sick, there's a lot of design considerations that are in play. So things like limit the user's field of view when you're moving them, or doing some sort of teleportation is, you know, typically a little bit easier to handle than the actual motion of moving from point A to point B. So just teleporting and being there mm-hmm. instantly, or being able to do things like some people really prefer snap turning, so that you can, you know, hit a button on your controller and it just snaps your view like 45 degrees to the right or left. Things like providing a visual cage when you're moving. So sort of like when you're in a car, you're moving, but you see the car around you, right? Your body perceives that you're in the car and the car is moving and not so much, you know, making you sick. Although car sickness is still a thing, right? So, you know, there's a lot of things yeah. you can design into your VR application that can mitigate a lot of those sort of symptoms. So that's probably the biggest one. But the other one is just the advances in hardware have gotten us to higher refresh rates, higher resolution. And when you can give your brain more input, it tends to put that motion sickness or the simulation sickness down. So, yeah.
Right. So I want to start bringing this kind of I think when people think of VR, these days they're thinking of putting on a headset and shooting at things, or riding a motorcycle, or, you know, some kind of like high intensity video game type thing. And so to some extent, it probably is sort of, there's this kind of disconnect of like, why are they talking about that on this podcast? This is the podcast where they seem to talk about, you know, business culture and communications and you know, kind of keeping people connected. Talk to me sort of about what has evolved in VR on this other, you know, in the realms outside of gaming.
Use case for virtual reality, but there are literally a ton of other use cases. I think video games is pretty typical because it makes money, right? The game development industry is also the ones who are the most knowledgeable about graphics and graphical user interfaces and things like that. So you see a lot of game companies getting into VR just because it's a natural extension of what they already do. Whereas like typical application development is a little harder. It's not as natural. And there's been a very huge transition for me in thinking of creating two-dimensional user interfaces into three-dimensional user interfaces. And man, that was a whole area of study and still is. I mean, I don't have it all figured out, but I read a lot of those books. And
Meaning what? Like watching a movie in virtual space would probably be a simple use case, but
or interacting
spreadsheets or
with buttons, like touching buttons to do things.
You know? Right, because this is what user interfaces and have been for the past, I don't know, 40 years, 50 years.
Exactly.
You know, on a two-dimensional screen, this is what we're used to.
Yeah. And when you add that third dimension, it really changes how you have to think about your whole application.
Right. You know, and when you think about it, even, you know, airplanes, cars, it's still a two-dimensional user interface, even though it's, you know, switches and buttons and stuff like that, you know.
On a screen, maybe?
Yeah, well, certainly on a screen, but I mean, you know, in an airplane, right, they're just all these switches mounted on the wall of the airplane, you know.
Right,
it's not that things are floating in front. I mean, there are things like, a stick shift kind of device or the steering wheel is much more three-dimensional interface kind of thing. But for the most part, you know, most of the switch kinds of things tend to be two-dimensional.
And that's what's fascinating is how can you take a user interface that is traditionally two-dimensional and find things that are in the real world that people understand, like levers and switches, and make them three-dimensional so that people can use them in those manners? Or like, what happens when I flip something over, right? As a user interface, or what happens if I grab this and just pull it up to my ear, you know, things like that. Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so communications, you know, again, when we think of these gaming, it's usually a relatively solitary experience. Maybe you can hear the people who you're playing the game with, or maybe they're in the game with you, but it's not, you know, call grandma kind of thing. Like, what has been the state of the art with that?
Historically,
and I guess also, you know, moving up to where we are now.
Sure. I think this is sort of the number one superpower, I think, of virtual reality. It can bring people together. A lot of times people talk about, virtual reality is going to ostracize us and nobody's going to talk to each other because they're in a headset. But in reality, the largest benefit of virtual reality is the fact that I can meet with somebody in a totally different country, totally different time zone, and feel like I'm exactly in the same room with them. I can see their body language. I can talk to them. I can get their voice inflection just like I would on a video call, but it's even more because I feel like I'm actually in the space with them. And what's more,
it's really immersive.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's more is I remember it as an experience that I had. Like there's a fundamental difference between seeing something on a screen and being in it.
It's interesting, the psychology of it.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. Cause one is that you're watching something, on a screen or, you know, on a phone. It's sort of this thing that it's sort of a surprise that you can interact with it. Right. That, like, you know, that first time you did a video call, like, wait, you can see me, you can, you know, like, this is a TV where you can see me, you know? But this is more immersive. This is an experience, and you remember it as, yeah, as a,
and not only can you meet with that person and, you know, talk with them, but you can interact with them and you could interact with the things that are in that virtual space together in real time. And so you could imagine that opens up a whole world of collaboration, in real time with three-dimensional objects remotely. So,
right.
Yeah, it's
right. So you could do 3D modeling, 3D
yes.
sculpting together if you were working on some sort of a device or developing a car, you know, something designed that was 3D design kind of thing. You could also, you know, work together on a whiteboard kind of
yep.
device.
Yeah, and these are yeah. some of the things I'm coming up with an article right now, like six ways to use VR for remote work. And you just hit on two major ones. One is, you know, the meetings that we just talked about. Another is whiteboarding. Like, you can have a virtual whiteboard built out, you know, sample applications around this where I can meet with somebody and we can express our ideas in 3D space. And what's nice about it too is it's not even limited to just the board, right? I can just draw in the air and then grab it and move it around. You know, it doesn't have to be on a flat surface that I'm drawing. The whole space becomes the whiteboard, basically.
So what's happening sort of technologically here? Like, are there specific apps? I know that one of the sort of buzzwords that I heard you using years ago, and maybe this is not the current state of the art, but was web VR, you know, that sort of this idea of creating sort of mirroring web technologies and sort
yeah.
of web interactivity in a VR environment and starting to kind of like get, talk
sure,
to me
yeah.
more. I should also mention, you know, there was sort of this first wave of VR that happened mm-hmm. in the 90s. And I was doing a lot of web stuff back then. And so there was this idea
oh, yeah.
of VRML, virtual reality markup language, and things like that, that have probably evolved a lot. But, like, you know, how does all of that play into this?
Great question. Yeah. VRML is very formational. It was a foundation. Tony Parisi is sort of the author of around in the early 90s. He's now working for Unity, which is a game engine company. And so what I want to point out there is there's this sort of paradigm. There's these two main options of you have sort of video game engines, 3D engines, and then you have web engines. And to a certain extent, there's a crossover. Like, there's so 3JS is a JavaScript library that can access WebGL within the browser, which basically accesses your GPU directly to do the processing. And so you can get
graphics.
Yep. You can get
stuff.
Better graphics, yeah. Better processing there. And so there are projects like, I think the most prolific one right now is Mozilla has a Hubs project, Mozilla Hubs, which is probably one of the better web VR pieces. There's
Mozilla, the people behind the Firefox yes. browser.
Their foundation has a project around that, which is geared towards creating three-dimensional spaces using web VR and has multiplayer built in. Or so you could actually go to a web address and hit a button in your headset, feel like you're in a three-dimensional space, and have other people join you so that you could do have a meeting and talk with them and do various things within that space. That's web VR. There's also a lot of different projects with game engines. And the difference between these two things is, I would say, quality, right? Web VR is a little bit like shoehorning an advanced technology into an existing product, the browser. And that comes with a lot of overhead. Like, the browser is not meant to do this. And so you even have Mozilla coming up with new browsers. So, for instance, the Oculus Quest has a brand new browser called Mozilla Reality, or is it Firefox Reality? One of those. And it's geared towards simply only being able to browse websites in three-dimensional spaces. And it takes out a lot of the overhead that traditional browsers have, and allows you to have like multiple browser windows open at once in a three-dimensional space, allows you to go to a web VR website and click a button and just be immersed in it instead of a space where your screens are now. So they're trying to make that sort of transition very seamless. But the difference between doing that in browsers and doing that with game engines is still, I think, a matter of quality. You can get a lot better quality in game engines because they've been built for 3D. They've been built for optimizing the assets and presenting those assets. They've have had this pipeline figured out for years through building video games, and browsers are kind of catching up to that. So you can, I think that's the biggest difference, really. It's just the quality. You can do more easier in game engines and still have, high quality things that respond in real time a little bit better than you can in web browsers. But it is catching up.
It's a little bit the tortoise and the hare situation. I mean, this was the kind of state of things in, I don't know, kind of historically, right? That even like Microsoft Excel was not something you could do in a native web browser because it was too complex. But over time, web browsers got better, and you have things like Google Spreadsheets now, and a lot of this kind of stuff is sort of caught up in a way that is potentially more interactive, more low common denominator as it's kind of moved to the web. But the faster the hare version of the tortoise and the hare race is still native apps, which oftentimes cost more money. Are how much of this stuff is free or are VR interactive communication apps like this? I mean, I know games, cost money, but like, what are we talking about in terms of investment? Let's talk about the equipment, but first let's talk about like
Software side. I think game engines are typically free as well until you actually compile that application and want to sell that application. Then you're looking at having a license for that game engine. So developers end up having some sort of license that they need to purchase in order to actually sell their applications.
Interesting. So there's actually a cost to the developers to distribute their app. So it makes it difficult for them to give it away for free.
It's not exorbitant. It's, it's sort of based on how many licenses you plan to distribute, basically. And so the more money the developer makes, the more they have to spend on those engines. But I'm not a super expert in that area, like what those pieces are. I've dabbled with Unreal Engine, I've dabbled with Unity, and I've dabbled with web VR a lot, but honestly my main platform these days is something that kind of combines a lot of this stuff into one package and also allows me to build VR applications without taking my headset off. I can be in VR and build the full application and publish and distribute it with multiplayer built into it, or you could restrict it without that.
Dude, you're blowing my mind. So it's meta, right? That you use a VR application or a VR application to create VR applications. It's a development environment in VR.
Yeah, and it's kind of like I had a friend kind of describe it a little bit like GitHub. Like the application itself is not open source, but you can build open source applications within it and distribute them. So you can publish these things as if you were publishing it on an app store, for instance. And you don't really make money off of that. It's more like if you want to give it out, that's fine. You could charge people for your time to build that thing. So there's still, I think, a client services model there to be had, which is sort of an area that I'm pushing for. And I don't know, it just gives a lot of freedom. And you can even, with the tools that are built into it, build these applications much faster than you could with traditional game engines such as Unity or Unreal, in which you still have to like take your headset off and do all of the things on your desktop and then compile it and then put the headset back on and test it out and take it off and make your changes. This, I can just do everything in VR without ever taking my headset off. And it's really powerful.
How much does a rig cost? I mean, if somebody's, you know, when they get to the end of this podcast, they think I need to figure this out. What are they in for? What are the options and yeah.
Sure. It kind of depends. Depends on what you want to do with it. Like if you want the high end gaming system that is going to give you the most power and highest refresh rates and everything like that, you're probably looking at something like the Index, which I think right now is $700.
That's for the headset, right?
That's just for the headset. Uh-huh. It was the headset, and the controls and the tracking devices.
Right.
So that's like $700 there. But you also have to have a video game system, like caliber system, with a really good graphics card, you know, enough hard drive space and power consumption.
Windows PC.
Mm-hmm. Which is, yeah, Windows PC too. Yeah, Mac is still, I think, catching up to this sort of stuff, as it always has kind of with gaming, right?
Mm-hmm.
Visual stuff. And that system can, you know, that can, you could probably get one for $600 that would be sufficient and go up to, you know, I would probably recommend spending somewhere around $1,200 on a system. And then, you know, additional $700 for a headset, if I were to recommend it for, you know, someone who is going to use this as much as they typically would use like a typical workstation for doing professional work. But there are also headsets that are much cheaper, wireless, totally standalone, don't need a PC for, that are really getting good. The Oculus Quest is probably the most prolific one right now that has the best support, and it's $400. So $400 gets you really good graphics. It's got a great ecosystem of applications. You can do things like web VR development on it, and it comes with the headset and two trackers, no computer. But you have the option to just add a cable and hook it up to a good computer to do even more powerful processing with it. So it's extremely flexible. And $400 is not a huge investment anymore, you know,
considering that it's a self-contained computer as well as the,
yeah. I mean, how much do you spend on your cell phone?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So with something like the Oculus Quest, would you be able to do interactive, you know, VR communication calls yes. with it, or is it more yep. game oriented?
You could. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's got full tracking. It has what they call inside out tracking, which is a series of cameras on the front that detect what your room looks like. And you can set up a sort of boundary so that if you go past that boundary, it basically does like a pass through of the camera so that you don't run into a wall.
Okay.
Know?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I've been keeping sort of a loose peripheral kind of, you know, watching this over time. So the state of the art a few years ago was that you had to mount some sensors on sort of the opposite yes. upper corners of a room that would then sort of monitor the room for the VR headset and gloves or controllers or whatever.
Right.
And then yeah. send wirelessly back to the computer, you know, back to the unit, kind of, okay, here's where they are in the 3D space and stuff like that.
Yep.
So what you're saying now is that you don't need that anymore, at least with this version of the technology, that the headset yeah. is keeping track of where it is within the room by having sensors that go out of it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. That's interesting. Wow.
Yeah. And they also just released this week hand tracking. So you don't even need the controllers now. It detects your hands, and there are certain gestures that you use in place of buttons. Things like pinching will get you a cursor that you could use to click and things like that.
So. Yeah. I mean, we're starting to see these sort of gestural interfaces with there was something that came out recently. Was it the Pixel phone or something like that? That had this gestural interface. You could, you know, change pages by just waving your hand over the device.
Yeah.
But you know, this stuff starts to. It seems a little bit silly with a 2D interface like a phone or a tablet. But
right.
But in a 3D space where there might actually be some use for that. That's interesting. So okay. $400. I've got an Oculus Quest. Paint me a picture. Like, what does it look like when I'm in a meeting? I'm a remote worker, we've bought these all for everyone on our team so that we can meet more immersively and interact. What's it look like? Is it Ready Player One?
I guess you could say some of that would be accurate. So when you put the headset on, you have a sort of home, and you're by yourself. You have this nice looking home that is rendered, and you can change it around to put applications where you want them to be, and you can then execute those applications, or you could hit a button to pull up a sort of heads-up display, a dashboard that will give you a sort of menu system to go further into the system to, you know, launch various applications or whatnot. And so for meeting somebody, you would want to basically launch a particular application and then invite them in, and you're basically meeting. And the area can look like whatever you want it to look like. There's sort of standard templates that you could use and then customize or
Okay. But this idea of whatever you want it to look like is a very developer-centric way of looking at it. Those
sure.
of us who just are more on the consumer side, it's like, well, okay, what does it look like? What are my choices? Like, what is a typical situation? You know, what does it look like?
So a typical situation is this a house that is overlooking the ocean, and you hear the sound of seagulls flying and maybe some ocean waves down below. And there's, you know, extremely nice desks sitting around the area that you could go over to. And, you know, maybe there's a fireplace in the side. That's a very typical sort of home environment.
So it's a very posh business retreat that we're having. Is that what it is?
It does.
Okay, nice. Everyone can have their business retreat by the ocean every day.
Yeah.
And then what do we look like to each other? Do I look like me?
It's so hard because it's like, well, whatever you want it to look like. But that's the thing. Like, so avatars are very
this is an indicator of kind of the state of things. We haven't quite hit that tipping point where there even is a typical, you know, kind of, you know, when we launch Zoom, we kind of know what a video conference is going to be. But 20 years ago, when you launched a video conference, it was, you know, much more kind of DIY and interpretive and stuff like that. And we're still a little bit in that point with the VR stuff, right?
A little bit. So Facebook, in particular with the Oculus Quest, has a typical look for their avatars, because you kind of have to standardize on a typical look in order to have some boundaries for customization, so that I can't walk into a meeting looking like a banana, for instance, right? So they have humanoid standard avatars. And, you know, this is one of the things that can turn people off a little bit. It's a little cartoony, right?
People want to express their inner banana.
Well, there is that too. Like, there's a very large contingent of furries in VR, people who, you know, want to look like animals. And that is it's a form of self-expression, and it's a form of reflecting how they feel, which is also a whole nother psychological avenue to go down that is extremely fascinating. Like, the whole idea of how I look in VR actually changing the way that I look at the world is a thing.
So the movie Ready Player One, for people that haven't seen it, it's a pretty good movie. The Steven Spielberg,
it's actiony,
you know. Actiony, movie. But particularly, you know, the whole idea of is it depicts this virtual world that a lot of this action is happening in. And you know, as we talk about this stuff, I think that there is some similarity, right? That some people look like a person, some people look a little bit more anime, and some people might look like a monster. You know, and ultimately I think probably it's going to be yet another thing where, if you're a business leader and create, you know, allowing these sort of virtual environments, you're going to want to provide some guidelines, you know, that people should be clothed.
Yes.
You know, yep. Not make each other uncomfortable, you know, like that, you know, I mean, there's some stuff like, oh, it's the Wild West, man, it's cool, you know, but there are some lines that are easy to step over. And even to the point where if someone is, you know, it could just feel like a non-expressive character, or, you know, if someone is sort of a lump, you know, like, as you're saying, a non-human character, you know, just like Bob comes to these meetings as a rock, like he's literally a rock, you know, just you can't get any feedback from Bob in these, you know, like it just, it takes some of these like metaphoric kind of things to like literal levels that are just like weird, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, I have a meeting quite regularly with a guy who looks like a Jeep and another guy who looks like a piece of toast with jam spread on him, and his hands are a spoon and a knife. And we have like these, we know each other, and we have these meaningful interactions in these places. And the avatars become a secondary thing. It's not that important. What's important is the conversation and the ideas that we're sharing, and the things that come out of that are what's important. Huh. Sure, it's a distraction maybe at first, but after you get to know the piece of toast, like, it doesn't matter anymore. Especially since you can change those so quickly. Like, it's just it's like changing your clothes. Hmm. It's really, I don't know. A lot of people put so much emphasis on how they look in the material world, and it sort of strips away some of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we see that in remote work stuff anyways, you know, that, that it becomes more about the actual interactions, the actual communication, the actual, work and output rather than so much focus on sort of the dancing around, and kind of the rituals that we've kind of developed around these things that can, you can forget they're not as important.
There is that transition period, right? To get people to adopt something, you have to give them something that they can relate to. And what they can relate to right now is reality. And so you have to create things that are realistic, whether it's your avatars or whether it's the space that you're meeting in order to get people to even understand the value of what you're doing. Like, we're just hung up on those visual things. And you have to replicate that in order to have adoption, I think. And then it can go crazy.
Yeah. Well, and in the early web, and, you know, I did a lot of work on the web in the early web, in the early 90s, every meeting was, you know, the client would say, okay, so on the homepage, we're going to have a picture of a library, and that's going to be our resources area. And then we'll have a picture of a bank, or, a picture, you know, it was like, we'll have a picture of a store and that will be where people go to buy things. You know, it was like you had to have this like picture of a thing, and AOL was like that for a while, and maybe it was a crutch that people, and there was a, point sort of in later in the 90s where we had to sit down with people and just remind them, like, it's a web page. It's not a village. So maybe we need to do the sort of village thing for a while. I have to admit, the idea of sitting down to have a meeting with Godzilla is a little bit much for me to get my head around right now. But maybe, maybe this is the ultimate in sort of acceptance and diversity, that we can sort of abstract ourselves. But it's hard to know where that line is,
Well, and it's a moving target. Like, as I got into VR, I really like anime. I love watching anime. Lots of different types of anime. There's lots of different types of, the actual styles and animations and stories. But I couldn't see myself as an anime character. And all these people were coming into VR with anime characters. And I was just like, I don't get it. But there's a certain ease of use with an anime character. It's a sort of middle ground between realistic and efficient rendering that you can get. And it also allows you to still be expressive in a humanoid form. So it's still very relatable. It's easy to render. And yet it doesn't give you that uncanny valley feeling of...
Does that happen? Where if I try to make a Jeff avatar and it's got a pictures of me from different angles and it just, looks just like me, except dead, right? Is that going to be like, except that it doesn't actually react in the same way that I do? Does that get weird? Is it almost sort of better for people to go for something that's a little bit more low res at this point?
I think so. Because the effort of rendering a realistic avatar that looks exactly like you and the skin, looks like your skin, the light semi-permeates it, with subsurface scattering, and the eyes, eyes moving is a sort of, it's a thing, but having realistic eyes, like, our brains are very attuned to pointing out things that are not real, to pointing out the things that are fake in our perception. We're very attuned to that. Like, you try to replicate it, and your brain just says, no, that's not real, and it feels uncanny. And that sort of describes the uncanny valley term, or that term describes that sort of concept. And so anytime I've seen anybody come into VR with a model that has been constructed out of imagery around them, it just, it's even weirder than just saying, lean into the awkward. Like, this is an awkward right. thing. You're not going to look like a human. Although that technology is also advancing. I've seen so much better looking scans, like body scans and textures and all of that stuff. But it comes at a processing cost. And we're just not quite at that reality stage. So...
Interesting. So where's all this headed? I'm sure that this realization that people can kind of get into this for $400 is a surprise for some listeners. It's a surprise for me that to realize like, oh, wow, that you could just kind of experiment with this for $400 and potentially even, you know, start to have meetings. If people wanted, like, what should they Google to like have a VR meeting? Let's say two people who work at a company together both get the Oculus Quest. We've got mm-hmm. the holidays coming up, although they might be behind us by the time this podcast comes out, but you know, yeah. they keep coming around. There's always something on the horizon for Valentine's Day. Get an Oculus for someone you love. How are people meeting? Like you don't download
sure.
Zoom.
Yeah. I think the highest thing that I see is just social VR in general. So that term is a thing, social VR. And there are many different applications uh-huh. of social VR. Just basically things that allow you to jump into a world and socialize with other people. Maybe they're random people. Maybe they're, you know, it's an invite only type of scenario. Oculus Quest has it built in.
I was going to say, Oculus yes. is owned by Facebook, who yep. is a communications company and has Messenger. And of course, they want to monitor everything you're doing and saying, but they're going to provide a lot of avenues yeah. for you to be able to
communicate. I think right now what they use is something called Oculus Spaces, which is a way that you could invite somebody into your home space and, you know, you see their avatar or you go to their home space, but they're also working on a larger social VR network called Horizons. But yeah, there is that whole concern of like the privacy concerns and the tracking concerns. And
it's like the chat roulette of VR, you know, just sort of like randomly meet people or go into their home and like,
if you want chat roulette of VR, go to VR chat. That'll give you.
I'm sure it's out there.
VR
yeah.
chat is another very popular social VR network that allows you to do a lot of avatar customization and space and world creation, and then meet there with your friends and do things like that. The application I was talking about earlier is some people consider it a bit of a social network because you can build that within it. Like you could create a space and just invite somebody in there and hang out with your friends. You want to create like a chill place to hang out or a meeting space. But it's also to the point where you can create applications, and that's called Neos VR, which I'd love to talk even more about. I just built an application within there for voters in Scheibs, Austria, who are voting on a new bridge for their town. And we built an application that allows them to switch the bridges, stand on the bridge, switch out the various options, and then actually vote on those options.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Wow. Okay. Right. So, another side of this is AR, which is augmented reality. And we're starting to see things like IKEA. If you download the IKEA app, you can, you know, move your camera around and see what the Hegen Schmegen, unit will look like in the corner of your bedroom. But there are, you know, other reasons that people might want to use, you know, it's not an augmented reality where people have to walk down to the river to see what the bridge would look like, right? They want to be able to kind of see it, stand on the bridge, and be able to decide democratically voting. And so to give them an opportunity to virtually
and visit the different bridge options. These folks are already going to City Hall to vote. And so we have a booth set up in City Hall where as the voters come in, they're given a QR code for their voting, scan that, allow them to put the headset on, experience what it looks like to walk on these different bridge options and do like a 5-star rating. I basically built 5-star module in VR, which is pretty awesome. And then they can take it
off.
So
they're voting in VR as well?
Yes, it actually,
Are they voting API. like rating like Amazon, or it's actual like legal voting in VR?
It is actual legal voting. They are able to do a 5-star rating, which communicates with an API that records their vote in a blockchain. So it's in a partnership with another company who does this voting API for local governments. And we basically built what amounts
There's
to
a lot
very...
of really interesting stuff happening here.
Oh yeah.
So
that's what I really want to point out here is like, it's not just the social things. It's not just the meetings. It's not just the games. Like you build actual useful spatial applications for virtual reality. And I think that's really where the market is.
Yeah. It's so you've got VR, you've got blockchain voting, which is a fascinating and thing that everyone should look into because it's really how it should work. Also non-binary voting, this idea of sort of choosing ratings, preferences on a scale, ratings voting, which is a thing that we're just completely not familiar with in the United States, at least. Well, you choose one, but it's not like who would be your second choice. Usually it's not the thing, you know, I would like to vote for this person, but only a little bit. Which is probably reflective of a lot of people's voting. Wow, fascinating. Yeah. Tell me about some other any other like stuff that's happening in VR that you're working on or you've seen people working on or that kind of might give people a little glimpse into the future for all of this. I mean, certainly from a, you know, remote work perspective, but just in general too.
My other topic I like to talk about in VR and participate in is just art. There's a lot of artists who, as you know, artists really push the boundaries of society in general and tend to cling to newer technologies for their work and ways to express themselves. And art in virtual reality is a huge community. There's a huge conglomerate of people that are just doing art. So things like Tilt Brush, you know, Tilt Brush is a very common one. Google bought the application. It's now a Google application, and it allows you to just paint with different brushes and textures in virtual space. So that right there tends to be a big clicker for people because they're drawing, but then they can walk around inside of their drawing. So that's a very big avenue. Three-dimensional art in general has always been sort of a thing, but now it's giving people like architects and professional car designers and shoe designers the ability to work with their creations in a three-dimensional space, which gives them a greater understanding of what they're actually making. It gives them this. So we use the term spatial awareness of what it actually is. So instead of having their brain translate their ideas, which are three-dimensional, to a 2D screen, they can work with it in three-dimensional space as if they were modeling it from wood or clay and actually take that and then give it to somebody to 3D print. So it, you know, the artistic area, and I like to, my sort of calling card in some circles is mandalas. I like to create three-dimensional mandalas and animate them and share them with people. A lot of people like this. So it's a great way of like just having self-expression. Yes, is a big thing. So art in general and crypto art even. Oh my gosh! So marrying VR and cryptocurrency in a three-dimensional space to create art and sell your art.
Too many buzzwords. I know, too many buzzwords.
It's amazing.
Hold on. I need to go
throw AI
shower.
In there, buddy. I haven't even started on that one. Yeah. It's wow. Yeah. Art is a really big area as well. So
there's also a lot of stuff that's been happening with, you know, immersive VR kind of stuff around therapy, you know, sort of mental health stuff, post-traumatic stress,
PTSD.
And stuff like that, where or people with chronic pain, you know, who might be immobilized or something, you know, like that, to be able to kind of go sit in the field for a while is kind of magical.
It is. It's a sort of therapy by distraction, I would say. Mm-hmm. But that is a very real thing to somebody who is feeling so much pain that they want to escape reality. If you give them that tool, it actually, it relieves the symptoms there. And we're even seeing it with children, like being able to distract them from some sort of procedure reduces their anxiety, which ends up increasing the rate of healing afterwards as well.
So dentists with virtual reality goggles, you're talking about. Wow. That's...
Well, they already like cover kids' eyes and put the headphones on and everything.
Sure, yeah.
You know, my daughter just had a tooth pulled, and I wish I would have taken a picture, because the amount of things that they put on her, I was just like, I should have just brought my VR headset. Like, she would have been totally fine.
to get some Minecraft done while she's in the chair there.
Minecraft in VR is a thing as well. Yes.
Oh yeah. So what's the future here? I mean, I feel like we're starting to get to the, I mean, the $400 headset feels like a bit of a tipping point. You know, we're kind of starting to get there where, if this is going to, a lot of the barriers are get moving out of the way. I mean, there's still sort of sociological barriers and kind of, you know, I mean, there's probably people who are listening to this podcast going like, these guys are crazy. I would never do this. And they might be right, but they also might be, just not relating to how the world's going to end, that 5-10 years from now, everybody will be doing this. And it will feel, you know, this first time I saw someone walking down the street talking on a cell phone, I felt like they were just breaking all sorts of societal norms. It was a horrible thing. It was totally rude. And now it's just the way of the world. So paint me a picture. Like, what are we looking at? What are going to be the advances in the coming years? And what should people kind of be keeping an eye out for, you know, particularly around communication in VR?
Allow me to proselytize a little bit.
Stand up on this soapbox. There you go.
I honestly see the future of VR and spatial computing related to what we do today with computers. 20 years ago, you didn't have a computer in your home, most people. They didn't know what a website was. Today, our whole economy is completely dependent on it. Like, if computers went away, websites went away, our economy would literally crash. That was only 20 years ago. This technology is advancing at a pace that is faster than the computers advanced as well. And it's advancing even computing technology. So the future is going to look like, I honestly believe people will want three-dimensional spaces to interact with their customers, more than they're going to want a web page. I don't think web pages will go away. I think there's always going to be a use for, you know, pulling up a flat piece of information and not have the sort of investment of going somewhere. But we already go places. We go to, you know, the mall. We go to the store.
Particularly when we're buying things that we want to be able to see and sort of experience. A refrigerator, right? That you want to go to the appliance store to be able to talk to the person and be able to kind of look at the different refrigerators. But that stuff could happen in virtual space.
Yes. Yeah. And it does. I've built some spaces like that that are sort of concept things. It's going to become more and more of a thing. And I do think that our economy and society will end up being dependent on it at some point. It'll just be part of everyday life. I don't know that it will replace things. I think, let me say that differently. I don't think it's going to take away from existing things. I think it will replace some of the things that we already do because it will do them better. And I don't know, that's something I want to be a part of. And I want to invest my time in building that sort of future technology. So it's sort of a choice at this point. And But I do think it's going to be a thing. I think VR headsets, I think they'll probably end up merging with AR. So VR and AR sort of merging and having a device that can do either or. Like you can.
So these days it tends to be separate. Augmented reality. A lot of the, you know, phones are capable of augmented reality, and they're ubiquitous. And so we're doing more like two-dimensional augmented reality kind of stuff. It's sort of using your phone as this little viewer of the augmented reality, while it uses your camera to kind of do spatial awareness and place your IKEA unit in the corner of your bedroom was the example I used. However, if you're talking about VR virtual reality devices that have these cameras that are facing outward to help figure out where they are in the room, those cameras could also, you just turn them on in the screens in front of your eyeballs, right? Mm-hmm. And now you're seeing the room, and you could potentially augment that too. So these things are merging together. Am I correct?
You are. Yeah. And they already are. Like, to an extent, I'm seeing augmented reality glasses. Like, they look like sunshades that you could just put on and have augmented reality.
So that's another one, right? Mm-hmm. So non-goggle kind of interaction stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you got to make it like glasses, because that's what people understand, and it's the convenience factor. Like, I put my glasses on every morning. So if augmented reality is built into them, I just have it at my disposal. And then it's just a flip of a switch eventually that actually immerses me into a virtual world and replaces my reality as well.
So virtual reality glasses that feel and look more like glasses than the current sort of goggly...
Yeah,
thing.
And if it's as simple as flipping a switch to move from reality to virtual reality, it becomes very convenient, and people like convenience and will use that.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know. Is it the decline of Western civilization, or an evolution of humanity, or just another weird thing that, you know, be like, oh yeah, he's got a 3D TV or whatever, you know, like, you know, just, it's hard to know like what all this means, but it's really interesting to keep an eye on it. You know, and particularly from, you know, this podcast, we talk about virtual communication. We talk about sort of communicating online. And this is increasingly sort of becoming an avenue in that realm. And yeah, I don't know. I, 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 I don't know. Like, I'm still not quite sold on it myself, but we're close. Like, I know that I'm going to, it's just a matter of like, you know, maybe in a year that I'll have some company on that just does this. They do all their meetings in virtual reality and it's the best thing ever. And we'll kind of hit it, not necessarily that tipping point, but we'll at least have those kind of clear and obvious sure. role models, yeah. which has certainly been something we've been looking for. You know, when I first started talking about remote work, we were kind of looking for that. And to some extent had that yeah. in Lullabot, yeah. right? You know, this is like, hey, we've got this really cool thing that we're doing. Is anybody else doing this? Are we doing it in a way that
Are
works for other people?
One?
And, Yeah, which is how Yonder yeah. got started and all this kind of stuff. And now this being the 82nd podcast, I feel like, yeah, we've talked to a lot of people yeah. that's worked for. And this idea that like, oh, that's not a thing that works or that seems crazy is kind of, you know, it's not really so much of an argument anymore. And I think we're going to start to see that with virtual reality.
If I may,
as well.
Since you're talking about podcasts and the number of podcasts that you've done, that sort of proves out the fact that, you know, remote work is a thing. There's also a really good podcast that I would recommend by someone you know, Kent Bai, who does the Voices of VR podcast. He has over 700 episodes now. And
Kent worked for Lullabot years ago, and I can say that Kent is nothing if not prolific.
He is. He really is.
Yes.
But he's
700 episodes.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
He's done a lot of work with that. And his big thing now is like trying to extract the amount of knowledge that he's uncovered in that in a more digestible format. Like, because to sit through 700 podcasts, like that's a huge time investment, right?
Yes.
Been talking yeah. with
80,
him about that.
82 podcasts is quite a time investment.
It is.
As well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, great. Jared, thank you so much for coming on and kind of shining a light into the goggles here.
My pleasure.
Was there anything that you wanted to touch on that we didn't get to?
I think that's pretty good. I will mention I have an article that I'm writing right now. That I'll probably end up adding this podcast to the end of, that is about the future of work, about ways that you could use virtual reality for remote work specifically, different use cases there. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, I talk a lot about VR things there. And my name is Circuitry, spelled phonetically, S-I-R-K-I-T-R.
Yeah, and that's your username on various things. But if people wanted to follow up with you, is that a good place to ask you questions and stuff like that?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I communicate a lot with a lot of different people on Twitter. Yep.
Well, Jared, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us here. So,
thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah,
appreciate
it. Take care.
You too.
We'll be right back.